Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can call me here during this hour and we'll talk about them. If you have heard the show before, or maybe today you'll hear something from this host and you don't find yourself in agreement and you think perhaps you should balance comment or correct something, feel free to call. I don't claim to be omniscient here, and therefore it's always possible I get something wrong. Feel free to call and correct if you feel so inclined. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And an announcement I have to be making today is that this weekend, tomorrow, and the next day, I'll be in Las Vegas speaking three different times. I'll be speaking Saturday morning, which is tomorrow, at just before noon, I think it is, but it's a all-day kind of a thing. And there's going to be other speakers besides me, but you can learn about it by going online. It's it'll be probably late morning I'll be speaking. And then in the evening, I'm speaking in a home. And then Sunday evening, I'm speaking in a home in Las Vegas area. So to find the time and locations of those meetings, you can simply go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under the tab that says Announcements. And there you'll find it. All right, and that's the only announcement I think I need to make today. So let's go to the phones and talk to Jacob from Puyallup, Washington. Jacob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Maybe you can help me with a question that I have. I have three verses to read and then my question. Luke 20:34-36, and ASV 20. Jesus said to them, "The sons of this age marry, and the women are given in marriage. But those who are considered worthy to attain to that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, for they cannot even die anymore. For they are like angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." Can you explain about this passage and how they cannot even die anymore?
Well, because they'll be immortal. When you're resurrected from the dead, you're not raised into a mortal body, but into the immortal body. That you'll be, if you're a Christian, you'll be living forever in that body with Christ in the new earth.
Okay. I guess that's all I need then.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. Okay, let's talk to Rez from the Bay Area in California, from San Francisco Bay Area. Hi, Rez.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted your opinion on something. Let me know if you think that I'm wrong for thinking this, or just I'm maturing as a Christian. But I saw this video of this young kid stand up on a plane, and the people were leaving the plane. They were getting ready to go to their destination. Everybody was standing up and getting their bags. And he stops everybody in the middle of the plane, and he just demands their attention, and he starts preaching Jesus to them. In my opinion, I didn't think that that's a time and a place, and people were getting kind of annoyed with it because they had to be somewhere. And there are people saying, well, there are people who are getting annoyed because the demons are manifesting in them. I'm just like, no, they were annoyed because they need to go, they want to go, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. When I was younger, I used to think it was very brave and courageous for somebody to stand up in a public place and start preaching the gospel. I thought it was a lot like Jesus or the apostles at the time. Of course, then I studied Jesus and the apostles more and realized that they actually never did that kind of thing. The only time Jesus could be said to have done such a thing was at the Feast of Tabernacles in John chapter 7, when there was a ceremony going on, which was, you know, everyone was focused on this ceremony. And Jesus kind of stood up and said, "If anyone thirsts, let him come unto me and drink." And he went on, but for a few seconds, he didn't detain the crowd very long. It would take about 10 seconds to say what he said. But it was during a ceremony where people were praying for God to pour out the living water upon them. And so he said, hey, if you come to me, if you believe me, you'll have living water. So, I mean, that was the only time we know that Jesus interrupted a crowd like that. Now, Jesus did a lot of open-air preaching, and so did the apostles, apparently. But they did it where they were invited or where they were anticipated. For example, the crowds would flock to Jesus. They'd want to see the miracles, perhaps. Or maybe they just were familiar with his reputation. They wanted to hear what he was about. And there would be thousands of people flocking to him, and he would preach to them in the open air. He'd go into a synagogue on the Sabbath, and they'd invite him to speak, so he'd speak. In other words, Jesus was willing to speak to anyone at any time, but we don't read of him actually, you know, getting up in a crowded place where people are going about their business, uninterested in what he has to say, and saying, hey, let me have your attention here for a few minutes. It seems to me that tends to have a negative impact on people's view of the gospel. It makes Christians sound rude. Jesus, when he began to talk to Nicodemus or to the woman at the well, Nicodemus had come to talk to him, so that was one thing. The woman at the well, Jesus made her curious by asking to give him water, which the Jews don't usually speak to Samaritans, so she was surprised at that. A conversation got started, and he started talking about, I have something called living water. And so, that you can turn a conversation into a witnessing or preaching opportunity is, I think, what every Christian should be willing to do if it presents itself. But we don't ever, as far as I know, find an example of Jesus or the apostles speaking to a crowd of people who weren't the least bit interested in hearing what they had to say. Generally speaking, they got their attention by doing a miracle or doing something like that so that the people were naturally curious and seeking answers to what's going on. Even on the day of Pentecost, there was a miracle of all these people speaking in foreign languages by supernatural power. And the crowd was saying, wow, what's this about? And Peter got up and he preached to them. That's typically what happened. The next time Peter preached was when he had healed a lame man, and the whole crowd gathered to find out what was going on. And he a lot of times at the open-air preaching, and frankly, preaching anywhere in the New Testament, was done in places where people had gathered either out of curiosity to hear an explanation for what was going on, and the apostles or Jesus would exploit the situation, or else they were invited to speak in a group somewhere. So if you just stand up and you're blocking people from leaving the plane, I'll tell you, when the plane lands, and especially if it's not early, I'm looking forward to getting off that plane. I'm usually sitting in the back because I get the cheap seats, and so I'm usually about row 33, and that means I got to wait 10 minutes, even if no one's blocking the aisle. I have to wait 10 minutes to get off the plane. If somebody's standing there preaching, I'm going to be thinking, I appreciate the fact that you want to preach the gospel, but I don't think this is a sensitive time. I mean, I don't think you're being very sensitive. I think you're probably going to make more enemies of the gospel that way than friends. So, yeah, I guess I see it your way, Rez. Thanks for your call. Let's talk to Leslie from Rancho Cucamonga, California. Hi, Leslie. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good.
Well, I have a little interesting dilemma that you might be able to help me with. But before I say that, I just wanted to let you know I've been listening to you for a long time, and I generally play all your recorded archives, and I have the last 3 or 4 years, and just impressed with the scholarship and your personal life and what you've dealt with and overcome, and you've been a good example to me, so I appreciate that. What I'd like to ask, my wife has joined a Reformed church, and we were searching for a church for a while. We went to a basic evangelical church, then we went to a Calvary chapel, and now she's found this Reformed church, and as you know, they're pretty serious people over there, and the sermons are very rock solid, biblically based. The fellowship is very, very warm people, exceptionally warm people. They sing very loud. They're very warm after services. The fellowship is just great. But I'm not Reformed. And, you know, and thankfully they're not a Johnny one note on that. They don't mention it much in the sermon. They might allude to
that's
it.
That's excellent.
But that's, yeah, it is, but unfortunately, I think I let the cat out of the bag a little bit on some of the sermons, because they would come up and ask me. I wouldn't volunteer anything, but they would ask me, well, what do you think about this? And I say, well, it was a fine sermon, except for this one little point.
Uh-huh.
And so that one little point was, you know, one of the five points. Exactly. So it was, you know, so I would explain what my difference was, but I didn't make a deal out of it.
Sure.
just this last weekend, I'm talking to a brother, and the sermon was a very good Christian living sermon, very strongly delivered, well done. But he mentioned something about, predestination the first total depravity. He just mentioned it in passing, but that's all he said. So this brother comes up after the sermon and says, what do you think of the sermon? And I said, it was a great sermon. It's no problem. Then I said, well, except for this one part. And so we sit down and start talking about it. And then my wife comes in and sits there beside me. And she says, well, can I listen too? And I said, okay, that's fine. So all three of us are talking, although my wife's listening way more than talking. So it's me and this guy talking. Then she gets up and goes and gets the assistant pastor, who's the worship leader, brings him back for added ammunition. So I'm
your wife did?
Yeah, my wife did. I guess she wanted to rebut some of the things I was saying, but she couldn't do it. But so he comes back, and we start talking.
What's the bottom line here?
Yeah, the bottom line is he rejected out of hand the parable of the prodigal son. So that was out of context.
Mm-hmm.
Then I bought up Paul saying he was obedient to the calling, meaning that he had a choice. That was rejected out of hand, essentially. And so my question is, and I'm sorry for the long preamble, my question is, he bought up Romans 1 and read all of that, and I'm familiar with Romans 1, pretty familiar. And he said, well, this is an example of a non-regenerate mind, meaning by implication that all those who are non-regenerate have essentially Romans 1 mentality toward life before regeneration. So, you know, but the position.
So, what can I do for you, Leslie? What can I do? What can I do for you? I got a lot of listeners, a lot of callers.
Yeah. So, okay, Romans 1, how should I rebut that? He's saying that that's the regenerate mind for all people.
When I debated James White about Calvinism years ago, I brought up Romans 1, and I said, can you tell me one place in the Bible specifically that teaches your doctrine of total depravity? And he mentioned Romans 1, and I said, okay, what verse in Romans 1 teaches that doctrine? And he said, well, the whole chapter is about that. It's about total depravity. It talks about how bad people are. I say, yeah, but who does it say it about?
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't sure what I was looking for, although I was simply looking for an honest answer. Who it says it's about, Paul said the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness of men who suppress the truth in their ungodliness. Now, he said, are you saying not all people suppress the truth in their ungodliness? I said, well, they might, but we're not told that they do. Paul doesn't mention all people. He talks about people who are suppressing the truth in ungodliness. Now, you, as a Calvinist, might say, well, that's everybody does. But Paul doesn't say that everyone does, and that's something you'll have to prove, not just assert. It's not drawing Paul's meaning from the passage. It's adding your own ideas into the passage. And I went on to, I'd go further and say, it says there they knew God. I mean, the people he's talking about knew God, but they didn't want to honor God. So they knew God. And it says they suppressed the truth. And it says they have no excuse. Now, if total depravity was true, I would think people would have some excuse. If you can't do anything except suppress truth, and that's what you end up doing, I would say that's like saying if you command your dog to fly like a bird and it doesn't do it, and you're unhappy with the dog because it does it, I'd say the dog has a good excuse. it's not able to fly like a bird. That's why, that's its excuse. If I'm told that I am supposed to be a believer, but I'm not elect according to Calvinism, and I'm therefore totally depraved, then I can't be a believer. And therefore, I do have a very good excuse for not doing it. And Paul says the people he's talking about don't have any excuse, which means they could have done better, but they didn't. And then it talks three times about how God gave them over. Gave them over to their lust, gave them over to, you know, the a reprobate mind, gave them over to perversion. Now, is that true of everybody? Is everyone a pervert? You know, and he describes the sins that these people did.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone I know, not every unbeliever I know does those things. I mean, there's no proof and no evidence in Romans 1 that Paul is describing the condition of every unregenerate person. He's describing a certain kind of people who reject the truth. But what about people who've never heard the truth? Or people who've heard it and aren't convinced yet that it's the truth? They might be still looking for truth, but they haven't been convinced yet that Christianity is truth. Is this them? Paul doesn't include them in the conversation. So the passage does not talk about total depravity. If people are already totally depraved, why would God have to, at a certain point, give them up to their sinfulness and give them up to a reprobate mind? According to Calvinism, mm-hmm. if they're not elect, they're already reprobate. So mm-hmm. why would God, at a late stage in this process, give them over to a reprobate mind? I thought Calvinism would say they already were reprobate. They're just reading into the passage. They find a passage that describes some very, very bad sinners. And they say, yeah, that's pretty much how we see everybody who's not a Christian. Well, maybe you do. But Paul didn't necessarily say he did, you know, and that's the point. So, I mean, when you deal with a passage in the Bible, you should basically deal with the passage in the Bible, not try to import into it your own theological prejudices. And that's what I'd say about Romans 1.
Great. And one last thing. They want me to sign up to be a member of the church. I'll call back about that separately. But thank you for your answer.
Well, let me just say this. It sounds like a good church. I'm not a Calvinist, obviously. But you say they don't hammer on it in the pulpit, and everything else you described of the church is very positive. The only concern I would have is that they might turn your wife against you, which I don't think they're trying to, but it sounds like she's taking sides with them theologically, against you, which is a concern I would have. I mean, I would think that the pastor or someone should talk to your wife and say, listen, your husband, not us. Your husband is the one who's heading your household. We are not. And you don't have to agree with us or with your husband. You're not required to. But you certainly should not be ever perceived as taking our side against your husband. That would drive off any good husband, I would think, from a church. But has she or you listened to my lectures about Calvinism?
I've listened to the first one and try to learn that as best I can, because, like you said, they all hang together. So if I can learn how the total of gravity, then the other four are non-material. But I've listened to part, and I've listened to it for years, many years, so I understand. But I haven't listened to all five of the programs.
Well, there's actually, I'm not thinking of my debate on it. I have 12 lectures on it.
I'm at your classes, on that topic. Not the debates.
Right.
They're great.
Okay.
So I'll need to get back into them. Thank you for your time, I think.
Okay, Leslie. Thanks for your call. Yeah, and anyone else who's interested in a deep analysis of the five points of Calvinism, we spare no effort to deal with every scripture Calvinists bring up and every scripture that they do not want to bring up. And so the series at the website, thenarrowpath.com, like everything there, is free. And you can go and listen to it, download it if you want to. The series is called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. You'll find it at thenarrowpath.com under the tab that says Topical Lectures. The series is called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. Okay, we're going to talk next to Max from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Max. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yesterday you were talking and made some questions in response to a caller. You may or may not recall, but you were sort of asking rhetorically, you know, why Jesus? Why faith? Why do you trust them? And I heard you ask the questions, but I maybe you ran out of time before you gave the answer. So I just kind of want to circle back to that, to just sort of ask you, just sort of baseline elevator speech, you know, why Jesus? Why is faith a beneficial way of figuring out life and the world?
Okay. Well, what I was actually saying is that I would like to ask people who hold other religious views. As a caller was asking about a friend who is New Age. I said that I'd want to ask them, who are they believing? I mean, obviously, if they're just making up their views out of their head, there's not the slightest reason to believe they're true, since we're talking about abstractions that are invisible about a world that no one can test in a scientific way. You know, if you're going to know anything about it, you're going to have to get it from someone who really has some authority. And if you're not believing what Jesus said, who are you believing? There's someone out there you must be believing, because you're getting your ideas somewhere. And I said, I'm not ashamed to say I believe Jesus, and that's where I get my ideas. Now, why Jesus? Well, there's a great number of reasons, of course, and I do have a lecture at our website called Why I'm Still a Christian, which answers that question. But I'll just say this. Jesus rose from the dead. Now, this is something that's historically verifiable, as much as almost every ancient historical fact is. Lots of good eyewitness testimony. Some of the testimony comes from hostile witnesses who still acknowledge that he lived, at least, and died, and that he was reported shortly afterwards to have risen from the dead. The people who were not hostile and who actually saw him after he rose from the dead lived with him for a little while before he ascended back to heaven, and then they were empowered with his spirit to do the same kind of miracles he had done. They were so convinced that they'd seen him risen from the dead that they were willing to die for that testimony. And that being so, we have good witnesses. Now, if remember, Christianity is not faith in a system of some kind. Maybe for some people it is. Christianity is simply having a life connected to Jesus, because he rose from the dead, unlike Buddha or Krishna or any other, founder of any religion at all. Jesus is alive, and therefore he's capable of interacting with us, and we with him, we can have a relationship with him. And that's what Christians who are, biblical Christians actually claim for themselves, that we have that kind of relationship. But the reason we believe in him is because we have excellent, witnesses who met him, recorded his story, saw his resurrection, were filled with his spirit and given the task of preaching his message to the world, and they did, and therefore we know about him. Now, the whole question here is not whether his philosophy is better than anyone else's. Of course it is, if he is who he claimed to be. But the real question is a question of a historical fact. Did Jesus rise from the dead? Now, there's many other historical things claimed about Jesus, but this would be the one that determines the validity of all of them. If he didn't rise from the dead, then anything else he said about himself is false. But if he did predict he'd rise from the dead and did do so, then that's about the best credential any religious leader or founder or human being could give to people, who have questions as to whether he knows what he's talking about and whether he's who he claims to be. So the fact that Jesus rose from the dead is a very important factor in our faith as Christians.
Okay, so it's interesting because it sounds to me like a big part of your basis for having faith in a relationship with Jesus is that you see, it's historically verifiable that he resurrected from the dead. And yet it's interesting to me because it seems you're still relying on objective methods, the same methods which do not apply to testing whether or not a God exists. You're applying those same test methods to verifying something historically.
I'd like to talk to you more about that. We have a break coming up. I'm going to hold you over, and we'll talk more about that. But I'd like you to restate that after the break. And here's what I want you to restate. In what way is the examination of historical evidence about the resurrection of Jesus, okay, that's the objective evidence I'm talking about, how is that similar to the ways that people argue for the existence of God? So Give that some thought. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and give you a chance to talk about that a little more. And the rest of you, we do have a couple lines open at the moment if you'd like to call and be in on our second half hour. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And we want you to know the Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We only say that because it costs a lot of money to be on the air, and we don't have any sponsors or want any. We don't have any underwriters or want any. We don't have any employees or want any. We have no overhead nor want any. What we have is a bill we pay every month, about $140,000 a month, to radio stations so that we can bring this radio program to you free. And the people who like the fact that the program is available sometimes want to support it. And if you happen to be one of those people, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do so from our website. The website has all kinds of stuff, all free, but you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away. We have another half hour coming.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we'd be glad to hear from you and talk to you. The number to call is 844-484-5737. In case you weren't listening at the beginning of the program a half hour ago, if you happen to be in Las Vegas or planning to be in Las Vegas this weekend, I'm speaking twice tomorrow and once on Sunday evening. So Saturday morning, Saturday evening, and Sunday evening, I'll be speaking in different places. If you are interested in that, interested enough to want to maybe attend one of those meetings, feel free to go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under the tab that says Announcements, and you'll find everything you need to know to join us if you want to do so. Now, before our break, we were talking to our friend Max, who we sometimes identify as our atheist friend Max, because when he first started calling us, that's what he called himself, and he is still an atheist, I believe, though we're not particularly talking about atheism. But Max was on the line with me just before the break, and we got interrupted by the break, so we're going to put him back on here. So, Max, what you said when I mentioned that I believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and I based that on the same kind of historical evidence you'd use to really test any historical fact, you said, well, why do you accept that kind of evidence, but you don't accept the evidence that is used, to prove there's no God? Is that what you said? Clarify.
It's not the evidence that I'm questioning why you accept it. It's the methodology. It's how you determine whether or not something is true or verifiable. Because God, and I understand this to be your position, so I'm parroting back a little bit, but I understand your position to be that God is not something, the existence of God is not something that you could verify scientifically because it is supernatural as opposed to, you know, naturalistic, meaning you could test it with, right. So what I'm asking then is about, you know, the historical fact which you profess that Jesus resurrected. You're saying that fact could be ascertained objectively with the methodology of like a scientific approach, of a naturalistic approach. I'm curious why you would trust that methodology to lead you to the conclusion that Jesus resurrected, as opposed to lead you to other conclusions that could lead you to other outcomes, and other outcomes being, you know, not Christianity.
Oh, I see. Well, for one thing, I don't know of any other religion in the world that is based on a historical claim. I mean, Buddha was sitting under a tree and he claimed to be enlightened. Okay, but what historical events could be pointed to show that what he was enlightened about has any truth to it? I mean, anyone can say, hey, I had a great experience. I saw some truths for the first time and I was sitting under a tree. But that doesn't give me any historical basis for believing that he's anything other than a person with some ideas. Likewise, virtually every religion is that way. Islam, Muhammad claimed that he had an experience, very private, which no one could test, where an angel, Gabriel, appeared to him and gave him the Quran. Okay, well, maybe or maybe not. There's nothing that can't be tested. There's no way to test if an angel appeared to him privately. Same thing with Joseph Smith, who wrote the Book of Mormon. He said, well, an angel gave him that too. Well, that was also a private thing. So, in other words, there's nothing historically verifiable even in the claims that other religions make. I'm not saying, therefore, they are wrong. I'm saying that if we are looking for a difference in the kinds of truth claims that support Christianity from the kinds of truth claims that support other religions, Christianity is the only one that actually has a verifiable, historically verifiable, event as its basic truth claim. And therefore,
so
it's the only one
that
can test.
You're saying, okay, so it's the only one you could test. How would you go about testing that? What's your methodology? Again, it's not necessarily
the conclusions I'm trying to talk about.
Methodology.
Okay. Yeah, you test it the same way you test any historical claim. If somebody said that, Alexander the Great conquered the world in the 4th century BC, you'd say, okay, what are your sources for that? And then you look back at the historians and say, well, these are pretty good historians here. These are pretty respected. They talk about other things, too, besides this. And, you know, they have a pretty good track record. And therefore, the default is to trust them. You don't have to trust them with your life, since Alexander the Great's existence is not important in terms of your, you know, how you live your life. But on the other hand, if you're trying to discover whether Alexander the Great lived or not, you check the sources, basically the historical sources. And that's what you do if you're trying to discover if something happened in the past that you weren't there to see. And this could be something that happened in your parents' lifetime. It could be World War II. You know, did World War II happen? Was there a Holocaust? Was there an Adolf Hitler? Did Japan bomb Pearl Harbor? Well, you and I weren't here at the time when those things are alleged to have happened. How do I know if they've happened? Well, I know them because there are sources, my dad, for one thing, who happened to be living at the time, but others, too, who I rely on. I think they're trustworthy sources. If I was, thinking I was living in the Truman Show or the Steve Gregg Show, you know, I couldn't trust anything. It might all be a fabrication around me. I might be living in the Matrix. But I don't believe that. I believe I'm living in a world where there are people who were here before I was, and who were as interested in being honest about what their experiences were as I am, and that they may have written something, in many cases they did, that can be instructive to me, giving me a handle on what happened in their day. And so that's, I assume that about every historical thing that I know about, everything that happened before I was old enough to check on these things myself, And therefore, checking on whether Jesus rose from the dead is, in a sense, the same category. It's a different category of event, obviously, because resurrection from the dead is a supernatural event. And, you know, the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor was not a supernatural event. But the way I would know if any historical event happened, before I decide if it's supernatural or not, is that there were witnesses, and that they were reliable witnesses. They were people who weren't trying to deceive anyone, had no motive to do so, people who were, alive at the time and saw it happen. These are what we look for in a competent witness. In a court of law, for example, a man will be condemned to life in prison or death based on what reliable witnesses have said. Of course, a false witness can really do some harm, but that's what you have to do. You have to vet the witnesses. And there's two things you're looking for in a historical witness is, do they really know what they're talking about? Ideally, were they there? Did they see it? And the second thing is, do they have any reason to want to lie about this? Do they have something to gain by deceiving me? when I vet the New Testament witnesses, I find that they come out pretty honorably in both, you know, they check both those boxes in a positive way, a good way. So, you know, I have no reason to disbelieve them. Now, if somebody says, I have reason to disbelieve them, then I'd be interested in hearing what those reasons are. And as far as the question of whether there's a God or not, of course, we can't prove God any particular way, even historically. But if Jesus rose from the dead, which is a pretty good credential for proving that he's pretty much who he said he was, then he's a good witness on the subject of whether there's a God or not. A better witness than, let's say, someone who never did rise from the dead. They don't have any more credibility than I do. But someone who died and rose from the dead, I think, has credibility to speak, especially if he said, I came down from God. I'm the Son of God.
I suppose so. My issue is, it just goes back to the fact that, I'm not satisfied with your explanation for your methodology as to how you evolve. You know, you said that you think these people are trustworthy sources. For instance, if your dad asking him about, you know, Pearl Harbor or something like that, what makes you think that the people who wrote about Jesus' resurrection are trustworthy sources? You know,
okay, well, that's a good thing. We should vet the witnesses to be sure. Well, first of all, they were eyewitnesses, not all of them. Some of them were eyewitnesses, and the others knew the eyewitnesses. The second is, like I said, they had no motivation to lie about it because none of them were really religious people who wanted to start a religion. In fact, when Jesus died and they figured he wasn't coming back, they went back to fishing. They were more interested in being fishermen, which is what they knew how to do, than starting a religion, which they knew nothing about. You know, they didn't have any motivation to pretend that Jesus rose from the dead, and they were all skeptical about the first report that he had until he appeared to them multiple times. So, I mean, these people were naturally skeptical, as much as any of us would be. They had nothing to gain by, you know, saying that Jesus rose from the dead, and their sincerity about it is pretty well marked by their willingness to die for what they say they saw. And they did.
That just makes no sense to me, because there are people died in the Branch Davidians thinking, you know, believing in
what they saw.
Dying for what they believe.
No, not. Yeah, and Muslims and Mormons and JWs, they all die for what they believe too. And so do some Christians. I'm not talking about people dying for what they believe. I'm talking about people dying for what they testify to having seen. Now, the Branch Davidians, first of all, most of them didn't die voluntarily. They didn't actually want the army tanks to come and shoot fire into their building and kill them and their children. That it wasn't exactly like they had a choice. Lots of people are killed against their will, and they may die believing certain things that are crazy. But if they were given a chance to say, deny what you're saying or we'll kill you, some of them, who knows, some of them might have said, I don't believe it that much. But even if they did believe that much, like a suicide bomber, a Muslim suicide bomber, he obviously believes what he's doing. But he believes it because someone told him, not because he saw something. He never saw Muhammad ride into heaven on a white horse, as his religion says happened. He never saw the angel Gabriel come and give the Quran to Muhammad. He's believing what somebody told him, and they believe it because someone told them. And it goes way, way back to people who never witnessed it anyway. The very first generation of Muslims believed those things because Muhammad said them, not because they saw anything that gave him credibility. I mean, if you study the history, there's just nothing. No one ever claimed to have seen any of these things. So a Muslim who will die for his faith is dying for his opinion. And that's what our faith is. If we simply have faith in someone, we've adopted this opinion that they're telling the truth. But the apostles I'm talking about didn't die for their opinion. They died for their testimony, which is, in a court of law, if you're not an eyewitness, you can't bear testimony. And likewise, I'm not talking about people who were not eyewitnesses for the most part. We have several eyewitnesses, and then we have other people who traveled with and knew the eyewitnesses and got, you know, the stories from them. And there were things to see. There were things witnessed. And so it's a very different kind of thing than Branch Davidians or Muslims or anyone else who give their life for what they believe, for their opinion. I'm talking about people who saw something and said so and were willing to die without denying that they'd seen it, because they believed it. They believed it because they saw it. So, I mean, I know you said that doesn't make sense to you. I'm sorry, it doesn't. I think it makes very good sense to me. If I'm trying to figure out if someone's honest or not, there may be many ways I could look at their life and say, well, they seem like honest people to me. But certainly, the strongest way I would know that they are honest is if they said, I saw this, I was there, and you can put a bullet in my head if you want to. It's not going to change what I'm saying because I'm telling you the truth. And that's the kind of testimony that the resurrection of Christ was based on, people who saw and died for what they saw and were willing to. Hey, we can talk again sometime, Max, but my lines are full and we only have a few minutes left, but thanks for calling.
Well, I appreciate you taking my call. Okay. I mean, I wish it could be more back and forth, but, you know, I appreciate you having
a
forum.
Well, you asked a question. I answered
there
it.
Are
you came back wanting more information about the same question, so I gave you more information. But, yeah, that's true. We have limited time, and ultimately, you know, I can only take one question or so if it's going to take a long time each time. But, yeah, feel free to call back anytime. You know, you're always welcome here. Let's see who's been waiting the longest here. It looks like it's Sam from Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Sam. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Steve, I have a two question, if you could concisely just describe to me or give me understanding to understand those things. First is, what is dispensation, and what's the dispensational belief about the book of Revelation? And then the last question, if you could, is in what historical context Paul wrote the book of Romans to the Church of Rome?
Okay, I'll have to go quickly on those. That's quite a few questions. What is dispensationalism? It is a belief system that was originated in the early 1800s by a man named John Nelson Darby. Some of his views had been taught in some form or another before his time, but he put together a system that was unique, which had never been taught before, which essentially made Israel the center of God's purposes in the world in the end times, and therefore his God, frankly the people you should be watching. This was not the view of the church prior to that. Now, what do they think about the book of Revelation? Their view of the Revelation is what we call the futurist view. They believe Revelation is talking about the end of the world, particularly about 7 years time, which they call the tribulation. They think the church is going to be taken out of the world in an event that's symbolically referred to in Revelation 4:1, when John is caught up into heaven. They say, well, that's like the church caught up to heaven in the rapture, and then comes the seven-year tribulation. After that, in chapter 19, you have the second coming of Christ, and after that, in chapter 20, you have the millennium, and then in chapters 21, 22, you have the new heavens and new earth. So that's what they think about that. Now, the historical setting of Paul writing Romans, it's an interesting thing because some people don't consider it matters what the historical setting was because they think Paul was writing sort of a timeless tract, just presenting the gospel in a sterile environment with unrelated to the situation. I believe that's not the case. Paul wrote this in about 57 or 58 A.D., less than a decade earlier, the Emperor Claudius had banished all Jews from Rome. Now, Jews are not usually Christians, but there were some Christian Jews, as well as non-Christian Jews, that were banished from Rome. Paul met some of them. When he came to Corinth, he met Priscilla and Aquila, who were Jews who'd left Rome because of Claudius's decree. We see that in Acts when we are introduced to them in Acts, I think it's 18 when we first meet them. And then and we also know from the Roman historians that Claudius did this. Claudius, the emperor, banished all the Jews from Rome. So they, when Claudius died, many of the Jews who'd been scattered from Rome went back to their homes and their businesses in Rome. And this is what had happened. The church had been in Rome before the time of Claudius. And therefore, there were Jews and Gentiles in the church until Claudius banished all the Jews. That means that the church was entirely Gentile for a few years anyway, while the Jews were gone. And the church in Rome developed into a Gentile culture church. But when the Jewish Christians came back, they had more of a Jewish culture church, and they're trying to merge with the Gentiles, as was, of course, necessary, because there's only one church. There's not two. There's not a Jewish church and a Gentile church. And it was hard for them to merge because the Jewish Christians were still wanting to keep the Jewish rituals, Sabbath and, you know, clean and unclean foods, you know, distinctions and things like that. And the Gentiles weren't. And so Paul had to write to them because the Jewish Christians were kind of looking down on the Gentile Christians as a lesser breed without the law and living in an unclean way. And the Gentiles, who knew better than that, said that these Jews are just locked up in legalism. And, you know, they're just not very enlightened Christians. They think they're still supposed to be following Judaism. And so there was a looking down on each other. And Paul wrote Romans, I believe, to try to patch that up. And the first four chapters or so, he's addressing primarily, I think, the Jewish element in the church about how they shouldn't think they're better than Gentiles, because they're, generally speaking, not better than Gentiles. He also talks to the Gentiles. In chapter 11, he tells the Gentiles not to be arrogant and boastful against their Jewish brothers. In chapter 14, he talks about some in the church wanted to keep rituals, some didn't. And he said, listen, don't judge each other and don't despise each other. Let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. We see Paul addressing again and again this situation, which we know would be existing in Rome at this time, because shortly before that, Jews who had been banished from Rome came back, and Christian Jews would join the church, which now had become very Gentile in their absence for some years. So that was the historical background, I believe, for the book of Romans, and it explains why Paul talked about some of the things he did the way he did. All right, our next caller is Kevin from Southgate, Michigan. Kevin, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Greg. Steve, I just got a couple questions real quick because I know you're limited on time. The first is, hold on a minute, I got it written down so I don't forget it. I don't know if you've heard of Lee Strobel's book, Case for Heaven.
I have not read that book. I've read some of his other books.
Anyway, he talks about near-death experiences documented.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering what your thoughts are on the validity of that.
Well, near-death experiences are, you know, something that can go all kinds of ways, because people who are Christians have a certain kind of near-death experience. People who are not sometimes have another kind. New Agers testify to a certain kind. So I don't know, you know, I don't know if some of these people are having genuine experiences. If they are having genuine experiences, I don't know if they are having them, if they're in touch with reality, or if this is some kind of a, you know, delusional state of mind that they have. I don't know. I'm not saying it is or isn't. All I'm saying is that people say they have such and such experiences. It's interesting how much each person's experience often seems to correspond with their worldview. When you hear people who say they went to hell and then came back in, or people went to heaven and came back again, it's amazing how the traditional pictures of heaven and hell seem to come into their description of what they saw, even though the traditional pictures are not in the Bible. And so, you know, I view such things with some suspicion. Now, I'm not saying nothing can be gleaned from them, because there are some kind of amazing things that people who died briefly in the hospital and then came back have testified to what they saw and knew, and things that they wouldn't have known and if they were, you know, blacked out. So I just, all I can say is I don't put any of my faith in any of these testimonials. That doesn't mean I think they're all untrue. Some of them may be true, and some may not. I would just say it's never been one of those things that I needed for my faith, because I have the testimony of Jesus, which is better than the testimony of anyone who's had a near-death experience. So I'll trust what Jesus said, and that's the near-death experiences can be, you know, listened to or not. by someone who cares more about those.
Steve, I got to interrupt you a minute because I know time's short, but if it doesn't back up with Scripture, I mean, like Paul's, hearing the Lord on the road.
Right. If it doesn't back up with Scripture, right, then they're not reliable, correct.
But the other question is, why do Christian people suffer the same as the world and get sick? I know that's a simple question. I've heard you answer it, but go ahead.
Well, I think we all suffer, Christians and non-Christians, because we live in the world and because the world is a place of suffering. It's a disordered world. There's dangerous weather that kills people. There are accidents that happen. You know, if your brakes go out on your car and your car goes over a cliff, it doesn't matter if you're a Christian or not, you're probably going to get banged up there, maybe killed. Disease is it's a biological phenomenon, and Christians have the same biological types of bodies that other people do. So, I mean, a lot of the fact that Christians suffer like others do is simply that we are people. We are human beings. We live in an imperfect planet. Now, we do expect to live in a perfect planet when Jesus comes back. In the meantime, we deal with reality as it is. Now, the Bible does say that there are things different about a Christian's suffering. In some cases, the Christians might suffer some things that they wouldn't suffer if they weren't Christians, like persecution for being Christians from people and even from the devil. The hostility of the devil is no doubt worse toward Christians than for non-Christians. On the other hand, Christians have God to protect them from such things, if he wishes to protect them. The unbelievers, the devil doesn't like them either, and they suffer from his malice as well. But I think Christians may suffer, more malice from the devil. But it doesn't matter. Suffering is suffering. It can be very bad, even if the devil's not involved. If it's just a virus, it can make things very, very bad. That's why. Now, why does God permit us to suffer, if that's the question? Because suffering can be good for us. Same reason that I would allow a dentist to remove, a painful tooth I have, even if we didn't have anesthesia. I'm glad we do. But if we didn't, I'd still have to have that removed or die, perhaps. And I would agree to it. And we have something wrong with us. We're not well. The human race is sick. We are bent. We are corrupted. We're addicted to sin and to selfishness. And suffering is the surgical tool that in many cases is intended to cure us. And many times suffering does make us more unselfish. If we suffer, sometimes we then are more sympathetic toward others and not always thinking about ourselves. Of course, that's a choice we have. If we suffer, we can become more narcissistic or less so. The point is that there are things in our character that aren't going to be fixed without suffering. Even Jesus, it says, was made perfect by the things that he suffered. And if that's true of him, he needed it less than I do. So I expect to be made perfect through the things I suffer rather than without it. Paul said, through much tribulation, we enter the kingdom of God. So that's for Christians only. Although non-Christians suffer too, they just don't get to enter the kingdom of God unless they become believers. Hey, I'm out of time. Sorry about that. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're on Monday through Friday and on some stations on the weekend too, a replay. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend. God bless you.